My name is John, J-O-N, initial T, for Thomas or Tom, and my last name is Barton. And I guess that's one of the peculiarities you grew up with coming out of the South. I'm from Texas, so if you hear a bit of a twang now and then, it's something I'm not quite outgrown since coming to California 20 years ago. But they do usually take your nickname from the middle name, so hence the Tom. The only thing worse than Tom is Tommy, and the only thing worse than Tommy is Tommy Jr., so I had the foresight not to name my son that. It's sort of a homecoming for me to come here tonight because I began my teaching career 17 years ago in Orange County at Valencia High School in the town of Placentia. Now, I realize that's butchering the Spanish pronunciation of Valencia, but that's the way they pronounced it. I'm originally, as I said, from Texas. My wife is from Texas. I'm sorry she couldn't be here tonight, but she's helping take care of some kids. A friend of ours is sick today. People always look somewhat incredulously when they find out my wife is from Texas. My wife, who is also a special ed teacher, I understand there's one of those here tonight, right over here. I always got a kick out of introducing my wife as a mentally retarded teacher. I don't know what your husband does to you, but I realize that's not fair. I really was put in my place when, back in about 1966, Emily was taking some graduate courses at UCLA. And that was about the time that the special ed department at UCLA did a survey, and they found that of all of the areas of study that one could go into for education, the group which had the highest grade point average were those in special ed. So that got me off that kick very quickly. Right. I'm a graduate of Texas Christian University, and I wish I could honestly say, having gone there, that that there was a great emphasis on the Christian aspect of it. But I'm sorry to say that while I went there primarily to study for the ministry back in the 50s, I really didn't last very long because, in all honesty, I went to learn about Jesus, and I learned instead about Niebuhr and Tillich and Barth and others, and I found out about midway through my time in college that I wasn't cut out for that particular ministry, and I praise God today that I didn't stay with it because I really didn't know what liberalism was all about, and yet I was about to become a minister ordained in it. My wife is 2 years was 2 years behind me, and we went through precisely the same experience through 4 years in college, though we didn't know each other from high school, and that was going to college to study for full-time Christian service, getting blown out of the tub with liberal theology about midway through. And we both ended up deciding to become educators. She with a major in English and history, and I with a major in English and physical education. We both minored in music. While I was growing up in Texas, I did go through the churchianity bit very thoroughly, and that's what prompted me probably to walk forward, as many of you perhaps have done at some time in your past at a church camp when everything seemed so emotionally right, and you lighted your candle and walked forward. And I really meant it as honestly and sincerely as a teenager could mean it, but there probably wasn't an understanding of the grace of Jesus Christ that I came to know later in my adult life. At any rate, I went through the churchianity game quite thoroughly, was active in youth group, and really spent most of my time working in the church, and it just seemed natural that one would become a minister as a result of that. But mercifully, God spared me that, and unfortunately, I didn't realize as God was plucking me out of one fire that I was, without paying attention to Him, jumping somewhat headlong into another fire because I began a bit of witness and testimony here, if I could, looking for the other side of life, and as a result, I joined the Marine Corps for officer training while in college. And upon graduation, was commissioned as a lieutenant in the Corps. And that's what eventually brought me to California. There are many things that I'm very thankful God has cleansed me of and forgiven me of from that time in the Marine Corps. And I'm very moved by Corrie ten Boom's illustration of that in all of our lives, that even the most heinous of sins Jesus Christ died for and His blood covers. And even we haven't the right, after God has thrown those sins into the water and put up a no fishing sign, to go back and fish them up again. So I can smile to brothers and sisters tonight and say that God has cleansed that part of my life. And yet, as you know, the scriptures say that nothing, nothing is ever wasted on the service of the Lord Jesus Christ. And a lot of good did come out of the time I spent in the service. I would think that the kind of discipline that is good for all of us in growing up. The Corps certainly helped instill. And there's a certain amount of leadership training that the Corps provides for you as well. Most of all, the Corps brought me to California. And though I'm originally from Texas, I've now spent over half of my life in California. And I've come to meet some very precious brothers and sisters and seen some really wonderful things happening. And I realize there are those who feel that because we are a great Sodom and Gomorrah out here, and we certainly have our share of problems, that you can buy some good beachfront property on the other side of the San Andreas Fault, I understand. But in fact, I believe that just as Jesus died for the worst of sinners, he also lives for places like California with all of its problems. And he wants us here to be the salt, the preservative of this community. And it was a joy tonight to hear some of the personal testimonies just in conversation of where Jesus had put you to be the salt in society. I did finish my tour of duty in 1964. My wife and I were married the last year of my tour of active duty after I'd been over in Japan. And if you remember your history well, there were no wars being fought then. So about the only kind of wars to get into were athletic wars. So I did pull some pretty good duty. And the last year I was in the service, I was pretty much involved in athletics, playing baseball and football for the Marine Corps. And that really helped a lot because I was able to step right into a good coaching job at Valencia High School. My wife and I, in being married the last year I was in the service, had sort of an interesting decision to make, and that was we both wanted to be educators. I still had another year to go in service, and yet she had an excellent opportunity to begin teaching, which she did at Laguna Beach High School. So we lived in San Clemente, and she taught at Laguna Beach, and I finished my last year at Camp Pendleton. As soon as I got out of the service, I was offered a job in Orange County to teach and coach. And Emily liked her job so well in Laguna Beach, we decided to stay. Now, honestly, Texans never plan to stay away from Texas. So every year it was, well, we're going back next year. We're going back next year. And we never bought a house. That was probably the dumbest thing we ever didn't do because we always thought we were going back. But I did spend 2 years teaching and coaching in Orange County, and Emily spent 3 years at Laguna Beach. And the 2 years I was teaching and coaching in Orange County, God resurrected a bit of background for us, and the church we'd been attending in San Clemente lost his pastor of some 15 or 18 years through retirement, and suddenly they needed someone just to fill in very quickly, so they asked if I would help them over the summer, because I'd preached there some while we had lived in San Clemente, and so I said yes, and that turned out to be a 2-year interim job as a minister while working and teaching full-time. I wish I could say that great things happened. Oh, we did build some extra Sunday school classrooms, and the attendance went up from maybe 40 to 120. But if anybody was saved, I'm not aware of it because I certainly wasn't preaching a gospel. I was preaching a good humanitarian gospel. I was preaching a good works gospel, but I certainly wasn't preaching the gospel, and the only gospel we can preach, and that's salvation by the grace of Jesus Christ. God is even forgiven me of that, I'm sure, and also has allowed us to keep very close contact with many of the people who were in that church at the time, and it's been beautiful to see how you can continue witnessing years later. And you know, sometimes when you're looking for an answer to something, you find out the first thing you find out is what doesn't work or what isn't right. And that really drives you closer to the truth. So I praise God that even when in my dumb sort of way I make mistakes, He still uses that for the good. I did enjoy my first 2 years of teaching, but I had a kind of frustration. There were probably two reasons for it. First of all, I did want to coach, but I really didn't want to coach in college. Unfortunately, I wanted to teach, but I didn't want to teach in high school. I think we have some, I heard someone over here playing basketball. Plays basketball, so you know the jock syndrome is such that if you're in college, and in my case I'm a family man, after you do your job, unfortunately, then you got to go stand in line with everybody else and tell some high school prospect why you should come to your college. And I knew that I wouldn't become involved in some of the unethical things of passing money near the table. So there was that frustration of wanting to teach in college but not wanting to coach in college. So really the better combination was to be in high school. And a very curious thing happened. As I indicated, my wife was a special ed teacher, so it was just assumed, since I was a football and track coach and my wife was a very good special ed teacher, that I must really be great with slow learners. And so they gave me every bonehead English class possible. And I kept complaining. I said, would you please look at my college transcript and the graduate classes I'm taking? You know, I'm taking graduate seminars in Shakespeare and Browning, and you're giving me classes. The most exciting thing I can teach is Lassie Come Home. And it began to be a little frustrating. And I kept thinking, there must be a better way. Well, then in 1963, the year before I began teaching, something very important happened that to this day affects all of us. The Supreme Court passed a decision called the Shimp decision. And actually, that was a pair of decisions, the Shimp-Murray decisions. Now, the Murray in question is Madeline Murray O'Hare. And that was a 1962 decision in Baltimore, Maryland, that took prayer out of the public schools. And the Abington School District was responsible for the Shimp decision, and that took mandatory or devotional reading the Bible out of the public schools. Now, I don't know what kind of elementary training you might have had, but I remember very well to this day in Texas sitting down in the third grade class and Mrs. Harrison starting the day reading without really any editorializing directly from the Bible. And so I grew up with that, and it was just a way of life. And I was never offended by it, and I think it probably had an awful lot to do with a kind of outlook on innocence that that hopefully our generation experienced at that time. If there was a lot of drugs and alcohol and sex and promiscuity when I was growing up, I really wasn't aware of it. I tell kids today as I'm teaching, I said, I know you probably think we're pretty square, but honestly, I used to sweat out 3 dates just to kiss a girl, you know, after the third date. And now I hear kids talking about far more intimate relationships on the first date, like it's, are you going to or are you not going to? And it's like, are you going to catch a cold or not, you know? And I think that probably had a lot to do with it, with the kind of fiber and moral concern that we grew up with. And since I wasn't in California at that time, I really don't know what it was like here. But I do know that there's something to be said about the availability of God's Word, even if it's not in a purely devotional sense, to help stabilize the moral training of young people. And that's something I want to be touching on tonight in a way, hopefully, that will exhort you to find new and more exciting ways yet to witness for the Lord in your various areas of work, especially for those of you who are educators in public schools. Well, if we can go back to 1966, I had spent 2 years in the public schools teaching at the high school level, and I made a very important discovery as an English teacher, and that is that no matter what high school you're talking about anywhere in the nation, no matter who the publisher was of the textbooks, there were certain predictable things that were happening in the curriculum. First of all, I found that with regard to mythology, which is certainly one of the great resources for allusions in modern literature, I found that in the ninth grade, everybody read the Iliad. In the 10th grade, everybody read the Odyssey. In the 11th grade, which is basically American literature, everybody read Paul Bunyan and Johnny Appleseed and all the myths and legends of our culture, even though we're a more infant culture. And in the 12th grade, when we studied English literature, everybody studied the Arthurian legend and Beowulf. I thought, well, that's great. And then I found, with regard to Shakespeare, one of the other kingpins of sources of allusions in modern literature, that everybody read either Romeo and Juliet and or Merchant of Venice in the 9th grade, that everybody without exception, remember, reading Julius Caesar and doing Antony's speech, friends, Roman countrymen, I've lend me your ears, you know. Everybody read Julius Caesar. And of course, since American literature doesn't study Shakespeare in the 11th grade, we packed it in then. But in the 12th grade, we didn't just read one play. We read Hamlet and Macbeth and Othello and All's Well That Ends Well. We read 3 or 4 Shakespearean plays. And I thought, that's great. These kids, many of whom are going to college, are going to get a tremendous foundation for an understanding of modern literature because of this great background in mythology and Shakespeare. And then all of a sudden, God hit me with a ton of bricks saying, wait a minute, that's only 2 out of 3. The other kingpin, in fact, it stands head and shoulders above these, is the Bible. No one's background in the study of literature can possibly be complete without an understanding of the Bible. And so, since we had units in the 9th and 10th grade, and I was basically teaching those grade levels, since we had units on mythology and Shakespeare, which ran about 4 weeks each, I did a little creative thinking. Now, that's something an untenured teacher is not supposed to do, right? No one told me any differently. I didn't feel wet behind the ears because I hadn't come straight from college to teaching high school. I'd had a bit of time in the military, and so I didn't feel like a rookie, even though I was a first-year teacher. And so without really asking anybody's permission, I constructed, I felt, a very solid 4-week unit on the Bible as literature, which I thought I would just set right in the middle of the mythology and the Shakespeare, right? Wrong. My principal came down on me with all fours, and he said, "What are you doing?" Well, since I knew the Shemp decision in 1963, the year before I began teaching, had made it very clear that the Bible had not been eliminated from the curriculum of the public schools so long as it was taught from for its literary and historic qualities. And I yanked out this quote from Justice Tom Clark, which I'll read to you a bit later tonight, and it made it very clear that the Supreme Court was saying nothing we have said here eliminates the Bible from an appropriate part of the curriculum so long as it is being studied for its literary and historic qualities. And since I, as a Christian, certainly believe to this day that God's Word can withstand the scrutiny of any kind of test, I knew that even in a secular setting, God's Word and its truth always wills out. And so I didn't have to worry about being purely devotional or religious or, quote, Christian, unquote. I knew that we could use many facets of the Bible in an academic sense and still let God speak between the pages and not break the law in the process, because I don't think God calls us to break the law in order to get the Word out. One of the most important things for those of you who have read our book, Schools on Fire, which, of course, I co-authored with John Whitehead, who is a constitutional lawyer. So whatever we claim here legally, I don't make that claim. I'm an educator, but he's a lawyer. And accordingly, our basic premise is know the law and make it work for you. We're presently writing our second book together called The Myth of Madeline. And the title of that book almost tells you what our basic premise is there. Madeline Murray O'Hara has not succeeded in doing 90% of what people give her credit for doing. But because Christians seem to persist in being ill-informed, and may I say, I tip my hat to you, Firefighters for Christ, being so concerned in reaching out with this phenomenal tape ministry to reach people so that, among other things, they become more well-versed and informed about what Christians can and can't do in any number of sectors. We just happen to be talking about education tonight. Well, our premise is basically that she has not succeeded in doing a portion of what people give her credit for doing, but so long as we remain ill-informed, it might as well be as though she had succeeded. Okay? So, I took the time to see what the Supreme Court decision said, and so I thought, aha, he really doesn't know what the law says. So this rookie teacher went in, and I laid down all this documented evidence on his desk, and I said, "You've told me that it's illegal to do these things. Would you please examine this? It's not illegal. I meet the guidelines of the Supreme Court decision." Well, then the real truth came out, and he said, "Look, I don't doubt that there are probably some things you can do with the Bible in the public schools, but don't you understand that's a hot issue right now, and we don't want the controversy around here. As surely as we allow this, we probably will have a Supreme Court case on our hands. Now, maybe somebody else is willing to pioneer, but we're not going to pioneer." Well, I felt that's not a very good answer. It certainly didn't satisfy me. And so I really felt that was a dead-end street. And so we prayed at that particular point and decided maybe there's another direction we should go. Well, I decided maybe the best way to do is to go into college, where I always wanted to teach anyhow, and become involved in teaching teachers how to teach, which to this day still is my first love as an educator. And so I applied for the doctoral program at UCLA in 1966. I love the way God uses details of history to affect us personally. You never think that something in history that has wide-reaching effects can so directly affect us as an individual. But God allows that. And in that particular time, I had a little bit of GI Bill. We didn't have any children yet, so my wife was still teaching. We had a little money saved. We were putting everything together to go into the doctoral program, and the icing on the cake was a fellowship of about $3,000 or $4,000, a lot of money in those days, probably a lot of money today. And so everything was set. We resigned our jobs in Orange County, and we were ready to move into the Santa Monica area. And if you remember that particular date in Californian history, you'll recall that was the time that our now President Reagan was then, for the first time, Governor Reagan, and one of the headaches he inherited in California was the free speech movement in Berkeley. And one of the stated solutions that he said he would utilize if elected governor would be to get to the bottom of that mess. And so one of the very first things that was done was to freeze the budget of the entire UC complex. And that normally wouldn't affect any of us individually unless we were already in that, but it did affect me because I received a phone call saying we're not going to be able to offer any new fellowships after all. We looked at our pennies and felt it really wouldn't work, and so thought, well, I'll stay in public schools. Well, that was about 2 years after the Watts riot, or the second year after the Watts riot, and the job we got was at Fremont High School in the Watts area. And there were 192 on the faculty. I mean, that some of you are in elementary schools where you got faculties of maybe eight. Can you imagine? And my wife and I were the only husband and wife team. And I taught in Orange County in Placentia, basically a very heavy populated region for Chicanos. And now all of a sudden we're in a 96% to 97% black community with 4,500 students. I've never been in a high school quite that large. And So once again, I thought I would give it a try. Well, that's even worse because the Los Angeles City Schools, bless their souls, are so large, so complex that if you want to do anything, it goes through about 25,000 layers of red tape. And so I never really got it off the ground there. I would make passing references to the Bible. You know, I was teaching a senior English class and we were required to read Paradise Lost. Can you imagine reading Paradise Lost and the theme of the fall of man and Adam and Eve and not make some references to the Bible? So that was really about the best we could do there. In the spring of that year, still nothing changing at the college level, I sort of just happened to a real neat situation. A man named Harold Conley, some of you may remember that Harold was an Olympic hammer thrower, four times for the United States team. He married Olga, who defected from Czechoslovakia, and they were married as a result of meeting in the Olympics. Well, Harold was going to try for his fourth Olympics, and he was a head track coach at Santa Monica High School. So that job came open, and I applied for it and was fortunate enough to receive that position. Well, now I was sort of walking backwards because I wanted to do more academically, and I seemed to be coming involved again in athletics. But for the next 10 years, God blessed some beautiful, beautiful things in our lives while I was at Santa Monica High School. For one thing, Santa Monica had a sort of prestigiousness about it, and I think it still does to some degree, academically. And I found that I could honestly coach there and teach at the same time and not get completely wrapped up into one syndrome or the other. As a matter of fact, I stayed in the classroom all day long and coached the last period of the day and after school. So all of the yearnings to be an academician were pretty well met there. And granted, the first year I was there, which was now my third year as a teacher, my fourth year as a teacher, I should say, and my seventh year out of college. So once again, I didn't feel like I was wet behind the ears and a rookie, but I still had to pay my dues, you know. As a first-year teacher, there's a pecking order. No one wants to admit, but it's there. And so I taught my usual retinue of slow learning classes and sophomore classes. And I want to be very quick to add that I don't feel there's anything wrong with that at all. But for the most part, schools are in sort of a driver's seat to hire people, and it seems to me, and this is just a bit of editorializing, if you'll allow me, it seems to me that a lot of schools want to hire, my field's English, so I'll stick with that. They want to hire people who are out of Stanford and UCLA, and everybody has outstanding grade point averages, and nearly everyone sees himself or herself as writing the next great American novel. Well, you get all these people together, no one really wants to teach perhaps the slower learning kids and so on. And so I think it would be very wise for administrators to realize that just as Jesus Christ equips us through His Spirit with spiritual gifts so there can be a mutual equipping of the body. A hand can't tell an elbow, I don't need you. But it'd be pretty sad if we had all elbows in the public schools or in a church. We need all of the parts, all of the gifts to function. And I think sometimes we tend to overload or overemphasize one area. A bit of editorializing, if you will. Well, I decided, well, you got to pay your dues. And so I said, okay, the next 2 or 3 years until I get tenured, I'll pay my dues. And 3 years later, God blessed it beautifully because by that time I was teaching a number of, I think, some exciting English classes. And once again, the curriculum just beckoned for that kind of witness. You know, we had a brand new textbook at that time. It's still in use, to my knowledge, called The Idea of Man by Harcourt and Brace. And the first unit, get this, was Paradise Lost. The second unit was C.S. Lewis, Out of the Silent Planet. How much better can you get? And the third was Alexander Pope's Essay on Man. Fantastic opportunities to drop a few little hints there, here and there about the Bible's influence in the writings of these men and so forth. And of course, it didn't stop there, but that was just to start. And I began to look around, and a very curious thing was happening at the college level. Religion studies departments were creeping up everywhere. Out of Northridge, within 2 years, it had become the largest department of all the undergraduate divisions. Now, here we are, less than 10 years later, and I now live in San Diego. San Diego State had one of the finest religion studies departments in the country. They are closing it down. Now, tonight, I'm going to share with you why I think that's happened. And I think we could still do some great reclaiming. There's a reason for its demise as an area of study. At any rate, with all these colleges teaching these classes, I thought, what a great time to suggest a course on the Bible as literature as an English elective. We already had a philosophy class accepted by the University of California as an English elective, so why not present a Bible lit class? Well, at that particular time, I had accepted a job as assistant minister at Malibu Presbyterian Church. Well, right away, there's a red flag for most school boards. If you've got somebody teaching at your school who part-time is a local minister, that's a red flag, right? Well, once again, the theme of knowing the law and making it work for you. You or I, either one, if we have done our homework and we have become fully credentialed, in this case by the state of California, with a life credential, then we have met the demands made upon us academically. And the fact that you or I might be a Christian is our business. Of course, we have to know the law and not violate it as we as Christians work in the public school sector, and I certainly never violated any of those laws. But certainly, there's nothing wrong, I think we'll agree, with being a Christian working in the public school sector. I had a friend who was a local minister, and had lunch with him one day, and he told me that one of his great disappointments was that he had been in that community 25 years, and he was trying, since that was the only high school in the district, unlike Los Angeles with about 30 or 40 high schools, if you want to get a class like Bible Lit, you got to go through all this red tape. Well, at Santa Monica, we had one high school and one school board. And as it turns out, two of the seven school board members were members of the church while I was assistant minister. So what a great opportunity to try to put it together. And this friend of mine who was a minister said that he had written a letter to the high school principal asking, couldn't there be a class on the Bible's literature academically, since he also knew that it was not illegal with regard to the Supreme Court decision in 1963. The letter he received from the principal, and he had saved it, and he showed it to me and gave me a copy of it, which I have to this day, says, well, you know, we have over 3,000 students here, but before we start any new class, we need to feel pretty assured that there would be at least 20 or 22 students to get it started. And I just don't think there would be that many students at this high school who would take such a class. Okay, so I was sort of running headlong into that kind of mentality. Well, I would be repeating a few phrases over and over tonight. One of them is, do your homework. Do your homework. The way to get a Bible lit class in the curriculum is not to go up to someone in charge, like a principal or vice principal in charge of curriculum, and say, what do you think of a Bible lit class? You know it's legal and so forth. You're not going to get a hearing. Okay? The way to get a class like that is to do your homework. Now, you and I know that administrators are so busy, they're not going to give you more than about 10 or 15 minutes of undivided attention, if that much time. They've got so much to do. And that's not a put down. I've been an administrator myself for the last 3 years. It's just the days are quite long. And you can't risk doing something that someone else says is okay unless you take the time to follow through on it. And the more controversial an issue is, the greater the tendency on the part of most administrators not to venture out. Let somebody else do it. Okay? So I felt that at best I could probably get the principal of the high school to look at maybe two or three pages of salient details from legal decisions. So I knew that I'd have to spend weeks, if not months, mastering an area that I'm not really gifted in, namely law, so that I could give him everything he needed to know to satisfy him to his satisfaction that if he authorized such a class, we would not be inviting some sort of legal suit. And so, with the help of a couple of friends who are lawyers, we condensed and condensed and condensed until we got 3 pages of digest of what the legal positions are with regard to the Bible in the public school sectors in this country and particularly in California. And then, in addition to that, we whittled down a 3-page prospectus to show what we would do with about 78 days of instruction. Now, if you've ever introduced a new class in the curriculum, you know that all you have to really do is give a course description and probably a course outline, identify your primary and secondary textbooks, and maybe just sort of outline what you'll do. You certainly are not mandated in any way to spell out what you're going to do every single day of the semester or the year. But I knew this was such a volatile area that if I just simply said, we're going to study for a six-week period the life and teachings of Jesus, well, you're asking for it then. And so I spelled out every single day. I said what we'd be doing, what passages we'd be covering, and what the objectives would be. Now, again, I believe with all my heart there's value in doing your homework. Fortunately, God saw to it that I had a tremendous ally in a vice principal, and I really don't know where she comes from spiritually, but I know this, that she is an outstanding administrator and an outstanding academician. And she happens to be the kind of person who isn't afraid of innovation. And so since she happened to be the vice principal in charge of curriculum, in the chain of command, she was the person who would ultimately make a decision as to whether we would take it to the school board or not. And so I laid out copies in triplicate, one for her, one for my department chairman, and one for the principal. And miracle of miracles, about 6 weeks later, I was asked to come down to a school board meeting, and it was at that night that they decided to start a class called The Bible as Literature at Santa Monica High School in 1968 and 69. Now, remember, they were somewhat fearful that we wouldn't get enough kids to sign up. And so just to be on the safe side, they decided, even though it was approved in November of 1 year and normally would have been begun the next September, and that's a pretty long wait anyhow, they said, well, we'll introduce it in the curriculum next year, but we're not going to let you start the class in the fall. We'll start in the spring, so if it bombs out, we get the summer as a buffer zone. Okay, I said, all right. So we started our first class in January of 1970. 86 kids signed up. And because they had only given us one time slot, and because they were the ones who decided it would start in the second semester, I told the counselors, any senior who signs up, I'll take on. Well, as it turns out, they'd already signed up 18 juniors. And so the balance of the class were seniors. And so they gave us a lecture hall. And it was, to this day, one of the most exciting experiences I've ever had. Now, it was not without its difficulties. To begin with, one difficulty was I was, still at that time, a minister working with high school and college age group in a local church. And a lot of the kids who signed up for the class were also kids I had on Thursday night for Bible study. And the first complaints came from them. Hey, this isn't like Thursday night Bible study. And I said, no, it's not. And neither can it be. But there are a lot of things that we can do here that we don't do on Thursday nights. Trust me, it will be something really worthwhile. But that's where the first sector of complaint came. And I think that's a significant detail for you to sort of pack away in your mind if something like this ever becomes a possibility for you or someone you know working in the public schools. The second area of concern was, with that many kids, you'd be surprised when you're studying the Bible how many kids in the public school sector don't own a Bible. And so I went to the American Bible Society. Unfortunately, Mrs. Mary Dorr, who was a member of our church, fortunately, was affiliated with them at that time. And I said, Mary, is there any way we can get some Bibles? And within a matter of days, she had the American Bible Society donate 50 hardback copies of the RSV. And to this day, I'm eternally grateful because those kids really, many of them didn't have Bibles. And many of their parents wouldn't even buy Bibles for them. A curious thing would happen, and that was I didn't check out the Bibles like I check out the English textbooks because they didn't belong to the school. They had been donated for usage. And so I thought, well, we'll use an honor system. And, you know, we ended up with about half of those Bibles missing at the end of the that first semester. So in the fall, I said, Mary, we need about another 50 because in the fall we have three sections of 30 each, and I need some more Bibles. So she got another 50. And so we put them on the shelf, and lo and behold, about another 20 were missing at the end of the... I didn't really get too upset, but I didn't know how many times I could go back to the well and ask for more Bibles. So I thought, maybe we better put a stop to this, because if you really want a Bible, you know, maybe you should go get one. And so I said at the end of that second semester, the fall of the next year, gang, a lot of Bibles have been missing. I've got to have enough Bibles for the spring semester. Man, I had Gideon Bibles, and I had Bibles, I had Bibles from Sunday school departments in the Presbyterian Church and the Christian Church. I mean, they heard this, get a Bible back on the shelf, and they went out and got them. So just a little sidelight there. Within 4 or 5 years, that class, which was begun in 69 and 70, I had developed into three sections every semester, two sections in summer school, and those sections were full, 36 and 38 each. And because I still had a vested interest in some scholarly endeavors, by that time I had asked for and had received assignments to teach philosophy, and I was teaching Western philosophy. And you know, that was neat, because most of the kids who took Bible lit classes, most of them, were already in churches. I got a very high incidence of Mormons taking the class, a very high incidence of Jewish students taking the class, and a very high incidence of Roman Catholics. I never really did a survey. I can just tell you from my experience that those particular blocks of students were frequently enrolled. But when I would teach philosophy, these were the skeptics on campus. These were the kids who didn't go to church. These were the non-Christians. So they had a kind of dilemma. Here's a guy who's teaching philosophy, and the class seems to be doing quite well. I want to take philosophy, but he's a Christian. You know, he's a minister. I don't want him going in there preaching to me. So every time those 30 to 36 kids would walk in, I'd have to prove myself every semester, you know. And the best way to do it is to show that you do your homework academically, too, as a scholar. Now, I can tell you from my personal experience that I never once took a class in philosophy in college that wasn't taught by an atheist. But I don't think it is a prerequisite that you have to be an atheist to be a good student of philosophy. And so it was kind of a neat challenge to show that someone could be a Christian and have scholarly interest and be a good philosophy instructor. And I'll tell you this. Probably in the 3 years that I taught philosophy, there were probably no less than about three dozen kids from the philosophy classes who, through inquiry and the spirit of inquiry, accepted the Lord Jesus Christ. And to this day, that's one of the greatest blessings I look back upon from that particular experience. Well, these kids in the philosophy classes, once we got through the first couple of weeks or so, and they realized that I wasn't going to get on a pulpit and start preaching down at them. And it was a very curious thing, because, you know, kids would walk out of a Bible lit class and the kids from philosophy would walk in. It's like they didn't even want to rub shoulders with these other kids, you see. And so they were very suspicious. But I just paid my dues as best I knew how and showed them that I was studying, and I could tell them what existentialism was. I could tell them something about Aristotle and Socrates and Plato, and something about Aquinas and Augustine. And it was very interesting, because Augustine was the son of Saint Monica, for whom our city was named, Santa Monica. And so every year I noticed the same kind of little thing going on. They would ask me, what's a Zen Buddhist? And I'd tell them. What's an existentialist? And I would tell them. What's someone who studies Hinduism? I would tell them. Then they'd say, what's a Christian? And boy, all of a sudden, you could see the antennae going up. You could hear a pin drop. Here it comes. He's now going to do his preaching. And God impressed upon me then, and I've never forgotten the lesson, learn to teach in the third person interior. Find someone who is a reputable source who says what you would like to say, and quote him. Let that say it for you. Now, teachers have been doing that for years. You know that. Remember when you were in high school and you had an English teacher? Teacher was fonder of poetry than of a novel, or fonder of Hemingway than of Faulkner. I mean, teachers always had that kind of freedom, and no one ever really questioned it. Well, when that question came up, I thought, boy, you know what I'd like to say. A Christian is one who knows Jesus Christ and saved, isn't going to hell, and so forth. But if I said any of that, I would have lost my job, and all that God had helped create would have been lost. And I don't think God was calling me to do that. And so the answer he impressed upon me, I gave it for years, was this. You know, that's an interesting question. What is a Christian? Well, you remember Martin Luther? Historically, he was the one who led the Reformation. Significant figure in history. He once said, and I quote, a Christian is one against whom sin will not be held accountable on the day of judgment, unquote. Now, that meant the kids couldn't go home and say, you know what Mr. Barton said today? I knew it. That guy's a minister. He was out there preaching. They couldn't do that. They could only go home and say, well, I learned what a Christian is today, and from Martin Luther. Well, then there were still some other opportunities to witness within the framework of the law. Because by the time we got to the 5th century Western philosophy period, we studied St. Augustine. St. Augustine, if you wish. And the most significant thing that happened in that particular period of history was called the Pelagian Controversy. A guy named Pelagius was a monk, just like Augustine or Augustine, and he argued for something called auxiliary grace. And quite honestly, I think we probably would do well to tell a lot of people today that that controversy took place 1,500 years ago. Augustine as a Christian, was Neo-Pauline. That is to say, he followed the teachings of St. Paul. Now, as it turns out, philosophically, he was Neoplatonic. And you couldn't really call him a theologian because the distinction between theology and philosophy did not exist in the 5th century. He was a bona fide philosopher. And so, for 2 or 3 days, we would study in our philosophy class every semester the Pelagian controversy. It was sort of a spiritual Watergate. And what happened was, because it ended up in a great ecclesiastical court battle, and ended up with Pelagius being excommunicated. Pelagius' argument was this. He argued for auxiliary grace. That if you do that which is right, good things should happen to you. If you do that which is wrong, then whatever happens to you that's bad, you've got coming. The greater the wrong, the greater the suffering. Now, when you do what's right and you suffer, then God intercedes with this auxiliary or helping grace to lift you out of the muddle. That was his argument. Augustine said, no, grace is free, unmerited. You and I know that to this day. And so that was the basic argument. And so I'd spend the first day talking about Pelagius and going over the argument of auxiliary grace. Then I'd spend the next couple of days going over Augustine's position as a Neo-Pauline thinker. And I'd read from Romans 3, 20, 25. You know, now do you see it? No one can be saved by being good enough. The law only serves to show that we are sinners. Now God has shown us a new way to heaven, not by being good enough, but by receiving Jesus Christ. We're all sinners, all fall short of God's glorious ideal, and yet now God declares us not guilty, acquits us of our wrong, if we simply trust in Jesus Christ. I mean, free game, right? Because we were doing it under the auspices of studying the Bible's influence historically and literarily. Well, the Bible lit classes and the philosophy classes continued on. I was teaching in the English department, but I was teaching all electives in those areas. In 1973, California passed some legislation called the Ryan Act. It had many far-reaching effects. Some of you who are educators in this room were credentialed under the Ryan Act. But there were other dimensions of the Ryan Act that to this day many people don't know about. For one thing, on January the 12th, 1973, the California State Board of Education adopted a handbook called, and I need to take a deep breath because it's only 32 pages long, but it's got about a 30-word title. Handbook on the Legal Rights and Responsibilities of School Personnel and Students in the Areas of Moral and Civic Education and Teaching About Religion. We just refer to it to this day as the handbook. Many of you know that Don Mumaw gave the invocation at the recent inauguration because President Reagan has been a member of the Bel Air Presbyterian Church. We used to attend the Bel Air Presbyterian Church, and I know that Don Mumaw has for many years had a great heart for public education. Well, this handbook that I'm showing you tonight, this green handbook, is the byproduct of the work of the Mumaw Committee, the Mumaw Report. Unfortunately, you won't find Don Mumaw or any of the people on that committee basically being given credit for it. But the work they did to try to provide some guidelines for moral education for students in California resulted in this handbook. And I thank God for the work of Don Mumaw. The committee that served as sort of the buffer between the so-called Mumaw report and this final copy was the Moral Guidelines Implementation Committee. And this handbook spells out some guidelines for what moral and civic education are all about in the schools of California and how we can indeed legally teach about religion in our public schools. Now, this next paragraph I'd like to read to you, I took it upon myself to put it on an index card and go around and read it to different people, especially educators, administrators, and so on. I had found out that there were some people who were reading parts of the Declaration of Independence in a parking lot and asking people what they thought of it and said, sounds subversive, sounds radical, I wouldn't become a part of it. Okay? Well, I thought, that's kind of neat, I'll try the same thing here. And so I started reading this. I said, what would you think of a school system that moved in this direction? Let me read this to you. Each teacher shall endeavor to impress upon the minds of pupils the principles of morality, truth, justice, patriotism, and a true comprehension of the rights, duties, and dignity of American citizenship, including kindness toward domestic pets and the humane treatment of living creatures, to teach them to avoid idleness, profanity, and falsehood, and to instruct them in manners and morals and the principles of a free government. They say, that's too religious. That sounds subversive. That sounds radical. They wouldn't have anything to do with it. I said, you wouldn't like to see this employed in the public schools? No, the public schools have to be more secular than that. I said, for the record, I just read to you from the California Education Code, section 13556.5. It's law. And for the record, it's still law. Now, we made reference to this in our book because, as you know, through the late 60s and early 70s, we have sort of been riding out the tide of a thing called values clarification. Do we have anybody in the room who has been in a school where that has been tried out? In a nutshell, right. In a nutshell, values clarification involves not talking about absolutes, but rather helping the kids to discuss certain things so that they can arrive at what values are meaningful to them, right? Now, for the most part, values clarification as a system of moral training is no longer really being used in your colleges. Unfortunately, for about 5 or 6 years, it was the thing. And so a lot of people who are now teaching were trained with that and continue to use much of what they learn, even though it is passé in schools of education. As an English teacher, I found that I cut my eye teeth on good old diagramming, and I learned the good old parts of speech, and it held me in good stead when I later became an English teacher. But in the middle to late 60s, had to sort of ride out the wave after new math and new science. We had a new English, and we started studying transformational grammar. And all of a sudden, the traditional way of teaching grammar was passé. But guess what? It too passed. And we returned to teaching traditional grammar. But you know, we were stuck with the same kind of residue. We had teachers who had gone through 4 or 5 years of college who never learned traditional grammar. They learned transformational grammar. And then they came to high school to teach. And then when we returned to basics and traditional grammar, they couldn't teach traditional grammar. So we had a sort of a parallel to this in values clarification. The thing we point out in our book on page 113 is that with that kind of statement, and we point out that you're probably going to find a statement like I just read to you from the California Education Code in practically any education code in the country. Now, to my knowledge, nobody's taken the time to write off and get 50 copies of 50 education codes. The education codes are pretty cumbersome and bulky, as you probably know. But I would venture a qualified guess that if you could put your hands on the education codes of any number of the 50 states, you would find something like what we just read here. So I don't want to suggest for a moment we're only isolating our concern for the state of California. I think God has seen to it that this kind of concern for moral training and ethical training for our young people appear legally in the education codes of all of the states. The point we make on page 111 is this, that the words calling for action in that statement I just quoted are to impress, to teach, and to instruct. It is a simple but powerful truth that no one can impress, teach, or instruct something which cannot be impressed, taught, or instructed. And clearly, what is to be transmitted in this instant are tangible, positive principles such as morality, truth, justice, patriotism, duty, and dignity, as well as the avoidance of such negative actions as idleness, profanity, and falsehood. Most people today would insist either there be no moral training in public schools because that is not the proper domain for secular education, wrong, as I shall point out with another quote in just a minute, or they argue that there are not tangible principles of morality. That's one of the most significant things that you will find in values clarification. They tell you there aren't precise, identifiable, tangible things we can call values. And in the education code here, you can see, yes, there are. And that's the point we like to make. Values are indeed principles which have met the acid test of appropriateness and longevity. To say that there are no values is to argue the point, because we know that without values, our society would not have become what it is, and if we don't return to those time-honored values, we're not going to survive. Now, what happens when values cease being important in the training of young people? I don't like to begin a speaking presentation with sensationalism. When you publish a book, you're not always able to absolutely control the way they wish to edit it, because every publisher knows its reading audience, every publisher knows what kind of clientele they cater to, and so on. So when John and I wrote this book, we decided that we weren't going to get wrapped up in pride and say, don't you dare touch our precious little manuscript. We decided that we would submit ourselves to a chain of command, and whatever editorial advisement Tyndale Publisher gave us, we would go with. And you know, it was really kind of a neat experience, because the young man, and I do say young because John and I are both older than he would call and say, we'd like to change this, or we'd like to leave this part out, or we'd like to rewrite this so it'll do thus and such. And we'd always say, okay. And after about the fourth or fifth long-distance phone call, this young man, who was 26 years old, said, you guys really are agreeable. You know, every time I call one of the other authors and say we're going to make an editorial change, he comes unglued. And that's when we told him we had made a commitment before the Lord, a covenant, not really to question his editing. Now, that doesn't mean that I would have written it this way, because he did do some editing. But I point out to you that in the book we do start out with a good deal of sensationalism, and I'd like to take the time now to share with you the first couple of pages of the book. These were stats from 1977, but unfortunately, if anything, they've changed for the worse. They've become greater in number and more intense. We know that every day throughout this country, approximately 60 million young people spend nearly 7 hours each day in public school classrooms. Collectively, that equals almost a half billion hours, or man hours, per day. And the question we raise is, what are these young people learning or not learning, as the case may be, that is causing many of them to become part of some of the following statistics? And I'm going to lay 10 stats on you now. I don't know if you're going to edit them out or not, but they're worth hearing. One, more than half of all serious crime in the Department of Justice defines serious crime in this country as murder, rape, aggravated assault, robbery, burglary, larceny, and grand auto theft. More than half of all serious crime in this country today is being committed by youth between the ages of 10 and 17. Two, over $600 million a year is being spent to repair damage done to school property by students. And I'm sure that in the last 3 years with inflation, that's approaching $1 billion a year. Consequently, many school districts now report that they're spending more money annually on repairing vandalism than they are on textbooks. Remember that the next time you want to put in a good order for textbooks, that a lot of that money is being diffused by going into repair vandalism done by students. I'll tell you, I'm substitute teaching now. I'm an educational consultant, an independent type, and I'm of my own volition back in the public school substituting. And the first day in San Diego I substituted, I told kids that they would take their feet off the desk in front of them, and that we wouldn't turn on the radio and so forth. And you would honestly think in some cases that I had taken away all their civil rights. But I don't apologize to anybody for telling them, you know, you take care of that desk and don't write on that desk, and you're not going to break that window and so on. And I encourage you to do the same, because if you're an educator and you don't, then the money that's going to be spent, and it jolly well will be spent sooner or later to make repairs, is going to be money that you won't have available for textbooks. And I don't think God honors that. There is a reason we should hang in there and be good, firm disciplinarians. One of my favorite philosophies as an educator is the philosophy of discipline. And I believe that this philosophy is appropriate for both the public and the private Christian school sector. You know, the last thing that Jesus did on this earth was to command, not to request, not to ask us to think about it, but to command us to make disciples of all people. Have you ever noticed that the same Greek root word that gives you disciple gives you discipline? It is a biblical fact that if you do not discipline, you do not disciple. They're two sides of the same coin. Third, according to surveys published by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and before I read this stat, I'm shocked to find how many people in turn are shocked to realize the federal government keeps statistics of this nature, but they do, and they report them annually if you take the time to research them. Health, Education, and Welfare has reported that nearly half of all unmarried girls have intercourse before graduating from high school. The corresponding figure for unmarried boys has now reached a figure so close to 100% that the government no longer keeps statistics on boys. Four, just under 250,000 School-age girls give birth to babies each year. Seen from another perspective, one out of every 10 girls will give birth before reaching the age of 18. Now, we don't try to overburden our readership with other stats, but in a speaking engagement like this, it's kind of fun to expand on it for just a moment. One of the things about this stat we didn't include in text I'd like to share with you now is this. We found that less than half of the girls who had babies before the girls turned 18, less than half of the girls got married. Over half did not get married. 75% of the girls who did get married were divorced within 18 months. Now, I don't need to tell you what kind of drain that has on the economy, because most of those girls who didn't get married and most of the girls who got married and got divorced shortly thereafter ended up on welfare rolls. And that's a drain on the economy, and it's not a very fruitful way of helping a child come into this life to have that kind of self-esteem problem. Five, the number of teenagers having abortions, and these are reported figures. I must impress upon you, the figures must be considerably higher because many do not report them, because the law, for the most part, doesn't require them to tell even their parents that they've had an abortion, has reached an annual average of over 300,000. A little quick arithmetic will tell you that 300,000, 250,000, we're looking at some pretty high statistics here. And if you look at a generation of high school students to be 4 years, grades 9 through 12, that means that we are seeing somewhere on the order of 1.5 million babies being aborted in a four-year high school generation, and something like 1 million babies being born to high school-age mothers every 4 years. Number six, the incidence of venereal disease among teenagers has reached epidemic proportions. Seven, drug usage is now a critical problem at both the secondary and elementary levels of education. Thousands of students in grade school OD each year, frequently while attending school, and many of these cases have ended in death. Eight, stat eight and nine really, really hurt my spirit, because I've spent the last 17 years primarily with teenagers. Teenagers now rank second in incidence as an age group of alcoholism. And interestingly, as we watch some of our victories in getting the drug percentages down, the corresponding figure is just skyrocketing upward in alcoholism. Nine, and this also disturbs me greatly, next to accidents, do you know what the greatest cause of death is among teenagers? Suicide. That's a fearful thing, not to have anything to live for at such a young and beautiful age. And finally, scores at all levels of basic skills have steadily declined among high school students every year since 1963. Now, call that a coincidence if you wish, but the year the Supreme Court eliminated prayer from the public schools and devotional Bible reading, ever since that time, without one single year of exception, all scores, SAT scores, achievement test scores, have gone down every single year without exception. Now, many people would argue the point and say, look, you're begging the question. Number one, you're suggesting that there is a correlation between moral training and academic excellence. You bet I am. You bet I am suggesting that. And the second thing, and this is the one argument you're more likely to hear among those who are not plugged into a concern for moral training, let alone a concern for Christian exposure or biblical exposure, are going to be educators who say, wait a minute, that's a bum rap on the public schools. I'd be the first to admit that the public schools cannot be a cure-all for everything. But as we say on page 15 of our book, public education can no longer excuse itself from any role of responsibility in preventing juvenile crime. I know that public schools can't do everything, but they can't dismiss themselves from being concerned at all. Relativistic attitudes about right and wrong as opposed to absolutes may be to some more palatable to teach, but they are no substitute for the kind of moral training that used to have our public schools in such a state of activity that we didn't need all the private Christian schools to fill the gaps. We didn't have as many kids involved in juvenile crime as we have today. In fact, let me lay one more statistic on you. Since 1960 in America, juvenile crime has risen twice as fast as that for adults. Seen from another perspective, again, since 1963, the population of the group ages 8 to 17 has increased only 1.5%. We have seen sort of a downward spiraling of young people population. However, since 1963, with that age group, 8 to 17, only increasing 1.5%, that same age group in juvenile crime has increased 300%. We cannot continue to survive as a country with these kinds of statistics spiraling upward. Now, I repeat, many believe that in the public school sector, there really aren't things the public school can do. I do not buy that. I know they can't do everything, but there are many things which can be done. Now, if I stopped at that particular point and said, that's my studied opinion after 17 years as an educator, if you agree with me, then we become a mutual admiration society. If you don't agree with me, I really wouldn't have anything to persuade you with. However, there are things to persuade the non-believers or the skeptics. Let me read some of these things to you. First of all, going back to that point in history, it was June of 1963 that the Supreme Court passed the Shimp decision, again, which took out Bible reading and prayer from the public schools. In November of 1963, in other words, after the Shimp decision, the NEA, that's the National Education Association, drafted a memo which said, and I quote, "Although the school cannot accept the entire responsibility for training young people in moral and spiritual values, it can accept its share along with the home, the church, and the community. And often, it must be ready to share that part of the responsibility being neglected by other agencies," unquote. So the next time you hear someone in education saying, hey, the school can't be doing those things, and in fact, it's a church's job and it's the family's job, you're more likely than not going to be tempted to give an argument, well, families aren't what they used to be, divorce rates are high, and the churches can't do everything. If you give that kind of rebuttal, all you'll succeed in doing is getting into a debate that won't have any outcome. If, on the other hand, you say, wait a minute, I'll agree with you, the school may not be able to do everything, but the school can do something. In fact, you know that the NEA has said specifically what we can do, and even go so far to say, if others are neglecting, we may have to pick up the slack. Again, do your homework. This happens to be on page 16 of the book. The memo goes on to say that spiritual values, quote-unquote, include, and I'm quoting again, unification of society, worth of the individual, personality and ethical character, cooperative spirit, community life, truth, reverence and awe, love for the beautiful, hatred for wrong, and, please listen closely, recognition of the greatest force in all of life, the power of God, unquote. That's from the NEA. Know the law, make it work for you. Is that worth a praise, God? Similarly, a position statement entitled Moral and Spiritual Values in Public Schools was drafted by the Educational Policies Commission. Now, that's a board which is jointly made up of representation from both the NEA and the American Association of School Administrators. This quote that I'm about to read you was drafted in 1964. All of this after the Supreme Court said what you can and can't do. This is a little longer quote, but let's stay with it. The development of moral and spiritual values is basic to all other educational objectives. Education uninspired by moral and spiritual values is directionless. Values unapplied in human behavior are empty. Now, some teachers may become so completely engrossed in the task of teaching French verbs, or the proof of the binomial theorem, or the repair of the internal combustion engine, that the moral and spiritual implications of their work escape adequate attention. Having a natural and proper respect for their particular subject matter, they may devote all their strength to the task of covering the material set forth in the course of study. Success in mastering the various subjects of study, however, need not conflict with the development of moral and spiritual values. Nevertheless, and once again I ask you to hear this sort of as a mental underscoring, nevertheless, if any conflict does arise between these two purposes, that is, the covering of a subject academically and pointing out the moral and spiritual values inherent in that subject, if a conflict does arise between these two purposes, there must be no question whatever as to the willingness of the school to subordinate all other considerations to those which concern moral and spiritual standards. Unquote. Again, praise God. Now, we think it's especially instructive to note that this NEA memo cited was dated 6 months after the SHIMP decision. That means that the position taken by the NEA, the Educational Policies Commission, and the Association, American Association of School Administrators, that those positional statements were drafted with full understanding of what the Supreme Court said education, secular education, public schools can and cannot do. Now, in 1968, the Gallup poll published its annual report, and I do not have the stats for 79 and 80 yet. In fact, 80 is not out yet. And this poll is called The Public's Attitude Towards Public Schools. And for the ninth time in 10 years, and my guess is now for the 11th time in 12 years, the major problem identified in public education, according to all the people polled throughout America, is discipline. Now remember what I said a while ago, discipline and discipling are really two sides of the same coin. If you're not training kids to have a viable, meaningful, positive attitude, and again, we're not talking about evangelism. We are basically talking about moral and ethical training, character training, if you will. Discipline and discipling are a part of that process. Interestingly, running a close second to discipline is the gravest concern among parents and adults in this country about public education was what is called return to basics. That sound familiar to some of you? You've been hearing that long enough. You're losing all the frills in education because all the money is now going to be spent on back to basics. Well, this back to basics movement is indeed a return to traditional grammar and multiplication table mastery and so on. Yes. However, according to the Gallup poll, there were a significant number of respondents who interpret back to basics to mean more than just mastery of basic skills and subject matter. And when these respondents were asked to say what they interpreted that entire move to mean, they said, well, in addition to mastery of basic skills, we believe it's important to return to a schooling of earlier years. And they defined such characterizations as, and again I'm quoting, respect for teachers, good manners, politeness, obedience, and respect for elders. Now, I don't want to belabor that point, but I simply want to say, in sort of summary for this particular portion of the sharing with you tonight, that there are indeed tangible values to be impressed, to be imparted. They are not some intangible things that we're going to try to discover. They are time-honored. In fact, if I might return to this Green Book for just a moment, reminding you that it was adopted by the State Board of Education of the state of California in 1973. I'm reading from page 2 of that book under a heading called Significance of Religion. Quote, the significance of religion in shaping moral and ethical precepts in this country appeared early in American history when the writers of the Declaration of Independence affirmed that all men are created equal and are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights. No single system of religion or morality may be prescribed by government. However, school personnel should assist students to 1. Recognize the sources of morality in history, law, and experience, and 2. Appreciate the significant contributions of religion, including respect for the sacredness of human life and belief in freedom of worship. Again, I will slow down to mentally underscore this. Prominent in the shaping of fundamental moral values in our society has been the influence of the Judaic Christian heritage. Unquote. Brothers and sisters, how much more of a hole do you need to drive a truck through? There is an open invitation, so long as you are a credentialed teacher, you are fully qualified to teach a subject matter you are assigned to teach, how much more of an invitation do you need, especially in this state? And for the record, after California passed this legislation in 1973, Wisconsin, Vermont, and Michigan passed legislation comparable in some ways to this. Now, when this was passed in 1973, my whole career took a completely different shift. We already had the Bible Lit classes going, but now I could see a whole new retinue of classes being taught. In fact, when you get back to the end of this book, on page 30, the State Board of Education is encouraging the development of some new classes in this area. I'm reading at the bottom of the page. It says that there are courses on world religions, courses on classical religious texts, courses on religion in America, courses on the Bible as literature. In fact, they list some others. Examples of courses that can be developed include religion and society, a study of the influence of religious views and the values on the social, economic, and political aspects of society, religion and the arts, a study of the influence of religion in art, music, literature, dance, and architecture, as well as sculpture, and man's religious experience, a study of the effects of religion on the lives of famous people. Now, they go on to say that they will not develop those courses, but they encourage the development of those courses. Now, for those of you who are educators again, you know that you sort of stand a waiting game at this particular time. You have the state passing legislation and encouraging this kind of innovative course development. Then what happens after that in the chain of command? At the local level, you have school boards. And then under school boards, you have administrations. And under administrations, you have department chairman. And under department chairman, you have the backbone of education, the classroom teacher. It's a waiting game. At the higher levels of echelon, no one is going to introduce a new class. But these kinds of classes will become part of the curriculum if you and you and you and I introduce these new classes. Now, there's some problems inherent in introducing new classes. I'll summarily dismiss problem one by reminding you what I said earlier from my own experience. Don't go in and ask somebody, what do you think of a new class like this? Do your homework. Get it out prepared so that there are no questions about it, and lay it before the person who has the authority to make a decision, or the persons, or the board. Okay? So that's the first thing you need to keep in mind. The second thing you need to keep in mind is that open invitation to develop these kinds of classes is not an invitation just to develop purely biblical classes. It is true that in the state of California, or for that matter, according to the Shimp decision reading, in almost any state, you can have a Bible lit class. But you can also have a history of religion class. Now, traditionally, Bible lit classes tend to be found in English departments. And I'm speaking somewhat at the secondary level now. And they're usually taught by teachers who probably have taught Sunday school, or in my case, had some seminary background. History of religion classes generally are found in history departments, social study departments, almost because of the name, I suppose. And then there's a third area called values education, not values clarification, but values education, and those can be found all the way down to the elementary level. Now, that invitation to teach Bible classes is open to public school teachers who are Christians as well as non-Christians. My personal opinion is, from a Christian perspective, nothing can be more devastating than for a non-Christian to be teaching a Bible lit class in public schools. And the only way that's going to happen is if Christians forfeit that opportunity. We ought to have so many Christians who are bona fide public school teachers, fully credentialed, standing in line to offer new Bible lit classes that there wouldn't be any room nor any motivation for non-Christians to be a part of it. Second, history of religion classes are going to be taught. Why forfeit them? Why forfeit philosophy classes to non-Christians? You don't have to be a non-believer to know that those things exist. Now, the Apostle Paul does warn us in Corinthians, and believe me, I had to really grapple with this as a Christian and educator myself. He warns us to be very careful about becoming involved in specious philosophies of the world, right? I learned at the Gothard Seminar that while that is, of course, true in principle, God still is witnessing to the unbelievers in all sectors of the world. It was the same Apostle Paul who said, the Greek I am is Greek, the Roman is a Roman, to the unbelievers and unbelievers, so that I will have an opportunity to win some to Christ. And from my own experience, I found that in employing that principle as a Christian in public education, there were indeed many, say in philosophy classes, who, because the right questions were asked, cause the spirit of inquiry, somehow or another came to receive the Lord Jesus Christ. And those are the greatest victories, I think, for us as evangelists. Okay? Now, I believe that right now we should defy all the odds in education and start right now, nationwide, encouraging the very finest of our young people who are Christians, who are in high school, to go to college to become teachers. Now, anybody who's looking at this suggestion from a purely logical point of view would probably say, that's insane. You already know the statistics, and I do. There are 1 million teachers in America today, fully credentialed, who are not teaching. Some by choice, some have experienced stage 3 burnout, as you know. Some cannot get jobs. So why in the world would you tell young people to risk four or five years of college to become a teacher and risk not getting a job? I'll tell you why. Number one, they're needed. Number two, if you are committing yourself to any ministry to serve the Lord, He will give you an outreach for that ministry. I believe I could look any young person in the eye and say, I don't care if there's an overage of teachers. If you're a Christian and you want to witness for the Lord Jesus Christ in a perfectly legal fashion in the public schools, you're going to have to get credentialed. That's going to be 4 or 5 very hard years of study at the very outset. But if you'll do that, I believe that God will give you a position. Now, in this room tonight, I heard that some of you are in schools where over half your faculty are Christians. So you probably have some neat fellowship. Some of you may not have those kinds of stats going for you. But you already know that there are things you can do within the framework of the law so that you can be a Christian and give a Christian witness. If it's nothing less than a smile and agape caring, you're going to make a tremendous influence on the lives of hundreds of kids that wouldn't be there if you weren't the salt, the preservative in that community. I believe that we ought to not only encourage the finest of our young people to become educators, and let me underscore something here at this time about that to clarify that. I don't believe that UCLA probably can speak for all schools of education. I referred to their study in the mid-60s about the outstanding grade point average of the special ed candidates. They did another study that I found quite interesting. They found that over 90% of their graduates who were going into education as teachers were coming from the bottom 25% of the graduating class. Now, as educators, we ought to be offended by that. We know that you don't have to be a brilliant scholar to become a teacher, but we ought to be attracting some of the finest students. Unfortunately, they're becoming doctors and lawyers and I would say engineers, but the times are kind of hard on engineers. They're becoming other things. They're not becoming teachers. And I think we ought to be out recruiting the finest of our young people to become teachers. Also, those of you who already have teaching assignments, there are many things that you could do to be retrained so that in addition to what you're already doing, you can do some specific coursework. If you're a secondary teacher, I've been harping a good deal tonight on Bible literature, but those of you at the elementary level, there are tons of things that you can be doing. And time doesn't permit in this presentation tonight to spell those out, but we do spell it out in Schools on Fire, and I would be more than happy to be available to you upon request to point out some things you can do and some people you can contact who would really open up whole new vistas of possibilities for you as elementary school teachers. I'd like to close by sharing 2 or 3 quotes with you. You'll forgive the English teacher in me. I happen to love poetry very much. Elizabeth Barrett Browning suffered a great number of disappointments in her life. And when we ask what someone can, what can you be doing as a Christian, basically what I've tried to impart to you tonight is that there are tons of things that you can be doing. And while time doesn't permit, really, I don't think, I would call your attention to the last chapter of our book called Action Handbook. And in that, we spell out a number of organizations which are already doing things. You may have a particular interest in something. We mentioned the National Educators Fellowship. There's a group called Student Action for Christ, Prayer Rights and You, P-R-A-Y, Citizens for God and Country. Then there are 3 or 4 creationist groups, and they've been in the news a good deal recently. There are 3 or 4 legal organizations. In addition to that, we have spelled out 12 things that we feel that you can do, and there are so many things to be done that you can find the area that is most exciting to you and just really plug into it and encourage others to plug into it, whether you're an educator or not, and you can begin to make a difference. I'd like to quote Elizabeth Barrett Browning, a little 4-line poem she once wrote with a biblical allusion in it, no less. Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. And only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit round and pluck blackberries." You know, I think God wants us to see, to really see, that the world is just a glow and a fire with opportunity, and we should be taking our shoes off in the presence of God's holiness and saying, "God, where can you use me? Here I am, send me." And I'd like to close with the very last paragraph from my book. "It is a privilege, especially when you realize how important we are in God's sight, one worth a thousand. It is a privilege and not a burden to witness for God in the public schools. So ask God for the joy in laboring to change public education to accompany the marching orders he issues to you personally. After all, people marching, trumpets blowing, and people shouting, as in Jericho, have been known to bring down formidable walls before. So why not the wall of separation? It was never intended that there be a separation of God and state, only church and state. You're Christians. There are tons of things that we could start tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. to do and live the rest of our lives and never grow weary or tired with nothing to do. God calls each of us to be salt, preservative in the community, and to be active witnesses, Acts 1:8, to the saving grace of Jesus Christ. And one of the most exciting discoveries we can make is how to be that witness for the Lord Jesus Christ with all of the constraints secular education and the secular world will put upon us. There are still ways, if we know the law and make it work for us, that we can be just as effective, maybe more so, than you ever dreamed possible in that public sector. We'd like to encourage you to do one of two things. First of all, we've only touched on the surface tonight of a lot of information that I think you'll find helpful if you're concerned with the issue we've discussed tonight. And a lot of that information is found in our book, Schools on Fire, published by Tyndale. You can either get that in a local bookstore, or you can write to us, Schools on Fire. The address is 2310 Orchard, O-R-C-H-A-R-D, Avenue, El Cajon, capital E-L, capital C-A-J-O-N, California. The zip code is 92021. It's also been a privilege in the past few months to receive phone calls from people across the nation who have read the book and are encouraged by some of the things that we've said here to take a stand for Christ in their community, in the public schools. And if we can be of more immediate help to you, I encourage you to call me, Tom Barton. Area code is 714, and the number is 579-6309. As I said earlier on the tape, I'm from Texas, and we have a saying there, "Y'all come." And it, loosely translated, means when we invite you to come see us, we really mean it. Well, in this case, I'll simply say, "Y'all call." Thank you.